Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What part do bats play in the Texas ecosystem, and what have scientists learned about these remarkable little flying mammals in the past 20 years? 33 species of bats have been found in Texas. That's more than any other U.S. state. And they roost everywhere from caverns and hollow trees to storm drains and abandoned buildings. And as my guest today will explain, new technologies have given biologists an increasingly clear picture of how bats live, travel, feed, and socialize all over the state. David Schmidley is a mammalogist who has served as president of the University of New Mexico, Texas Tech, and Oklahoma State University. His new book is an updated edition of the original Bats of Texas, which he also wrote. This version is co-authored by Lauren Ammerman and Christine Heiss. Dave, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Start, if you would, by telling us what makes bats such an interesting animal to such interesting animals to study.
Well, there are many reasons. I would say one of the most important is that they're the only mammals that have developed the ability of true flight. Some mammals are able to glide, but bats are the only ones that truly fly, and that makes them unique. The second interesting thing about bats is they have a very interesting life history. For example, they use echolocation to locate their prey, to move around in their environment. And these are high-pulse echolocation signals that are, for the most part, not audible to people. But they're very effective in allowing bats to navigate their environment. They can locate very small insects flying in a wide space. They can locate a human hair on a pond, just to give you an example. And then a third thing is that they're sort of unusual. Most small mammals, and bats are relatively small compared to other mammals, most small mammals have lots of young and short lifespans. Bats are kind of the opposite of that. They typically have only one young. There are a few that have twins or three or four, but for the most part, they have only one young, and they're fairly long-lived. There are records of bats living anywhere from 15 to 20 years in the wild.
Wow.
So they're really unique compared to other mammals.
And they're most closely related, Dave, to shrews, is that right?
Well, that's what some people think. There are a lot of species of bats, and they're distributed all over the world. And there's some indication now that the larger bats in the old world, Europe, Asia, places like that, may have a different origin than bats in the new world. And that's being studied right now. People are using DNA technology and other new sophisticated techniques of biotechnology to look at the relationships of bats.
How did they develop the ability to fly over time?
Well, that's because after they evolved, and as you said, probably from insectivores, and we know that bats, when they first appear in the fossil record, already have the ability to fly. So we really don't know or fully understand all of the details of how flight evolved. One can imagine that it likely started out as gliding, that there was some success in that in obtaining new prey, and that very quickly bats moved from gliders to active flyers. But we don't really have a fossil record that substantiates a lot of that. There is new promise with fossils coming out of China that likely will shed some more light on this. But that's really an unknown question about the evolution of bats. There's a lot of speculation, but no certainty.
And the way they use their wings to fly is very much unlike the way birds use their wings.
That's correct. They do. They're not like birds in that regard. And they have there's a lot of variation in the wings of bats that typically determine how they fly. For example, some bats fly like hummingbirds almost. They hover, and those are the nectar-feeding bats. Other bats have long, narrow wings, and they're high flyers, and they fly long distances. And then there are bats that are sort of intermediate, and they fly and flitter around in the air almost like butterflies. So there's a lot of variation in how bats fly, but they're typically not like birds, and their muscle structures reflect that.
And bees get all the credit, but those nectar-feeding bats have a lot to do with pollinating crops and flowers and plants.
That's true. Nectar-feeding bats are really important, particularly in the tropics. For example, many of your listeners may be fond of a drink known as tequila.
Yes, I think so.
And there is a bat called a tequila bat, okay? And that bat actually occurs in Texas, down in the Big Bend country. And it pollinates the flower and the plant from which tequila is made. So nectar-feeding bats are extremely important and pollinate many important plants in the tropics.
So you mentioned earlier echolocation and how bats use it to find insects. This is one of the most remarkable things to me, that they're out there in the dark and they can find these things that are flying around. How does that process work?
Well, they have pulses that are produced and come out of their mouths. They have a little device in their ears, most bats do, called a tragus. And that device acts almost like a horn. It allows them to sharply focus their echolocating pulses, which they can vary by frequency. Okay, most of them, as I said earlier, are not audible to people. Mm-hmm. But as they move in on their prey, they're able to compensate for the Doppler effect, which is well known in physics, where you have two moving objects moving at different speeds. And bats are able to compensate for that. And they increase their buzzes or their echolocating pulses as they get closer to their target. And then once they approach the target, they're able to hone in on it very quickly and very successfully. For example, if you took a large barn and you put one bat in that barn and one small flying insect, a gnat or something, in a matter of just a minute or so, that bat would be able to locate that insect in that space and consume it.
Wow.
So they're pretty remarkable with regard to their echolocation. We have never, as sophisticated as the U.S. military is, on its most sophisticated aircraft and submarines, it does not have an echolocating capability that's anywhere close to being as efficient as bats.
Does anything about those sounds they make help to sort of stun the insects that they're after?
Well, that's a debatable thing. Some people think that may happen. And there are also some insects, particularly some moths, that are able to trickle out false signals, and they try to fool the bats. For example, one of the most intriguing bats in Texas is the big spotted bat, which is a pretty rare bat around the country, but is actually not uncommon in the Big Bend area. And the spotted bat is a high-flying bat, has very large ears, and it feeds primarily on large moths at relatively high elevations. And so those moths will actually try to trick those bats by sending out false signals. And then the bats, of course, compensate for that, and it's almost like aerial warfare going on in the skies above the national park.
And then you have another element, because you have the bats flying around, the ones that eat insects, trying to get the insects, and other things are flying around, notably owls, trying to get the bats.
That's true, and hawks as well. If you go to Bracken Cave and you watch the bat flight there, which is one of the most incredible bat flights anywhere in the world, you will see as the bats come out of that cave, and they number anywhere from 4 to 8, 10 million bats, and they come up in a swirl that's picked up on radar at the San Antonio airport. You can see red-tailed hawks diving into that flight of bats and feeding on bats.
So last summer we were in Carlsbad Caverns, my family, and saw, of course, the flight of the bats, which you have to see when you're there. And I just was marveling at the fact that anybody could count this population. Can you talk about how technologies have evolved? First of all, how you begin to get a count of bats and how you monitor it over time?
Okay, well, the old technology was to find some way of trying to estimate numbers and then extrapolating over time and space. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you might go into a cave and count the number of bats in, say, a square meter of the cave and get some estimate about how many meters of the, what percentage of the bats' cave was covered in bats, and do some simple multiplication to get estimates. Mm-hmm. And those turns out are highly variable. For example, we've had estimates from Bracken Cave in the hill country of anywhere from 20 to 40 million bats occupying that cave using that kind of technology.
That's a big variable. That's a big variation.
That's a huge variable. But there is an outstanding bat biologist at Boston University named Tom Coons. He's one of the leading bat biologists in the world. And Tom has developed the use of infrared thermal radiography. And, you know, anything that produces heat can be picked up with infrared technology. And he's actually gone into the caves now and been able to get some precise estimates, very close counts to how many bats are there. And in most cases, the numbers are far below the estimated numbers from these cruder technologies.
How many insects would a bat need to eat in an average day based on its body weight?
Well, that would depend on the bat. I can tell you that it's been estimated that the bats from Bracken Cave, that those bats consume about 4 billion insects a night. And those insects, by the way, include corn earworms, cotton boll worms, and army worms. And those, anyone knows, those are very damaging insects. And it's been estimated that that 1 million bats could prevent the development of about 5 million moth larvae per night.
Wow.
Simply by foraging for adult moths. And they've actually gone in one 8-county region in south central Texas, down in what's known as the Winter Garden region, and calculated that bats save farmers approximately 12% of the total value of the cotton crop produced there. And that's roughly about $750,000 per year, just in that one 8-county area. So bats consume a lot of insects. They are the major predator of night-flying insects. And many of those insects are very important agricultural pests. And so there's real value to having bats. And, you know, that's part of the dilemma. As some people, they think when they see a bat, they get concerned because they think all bats have rabies, which is not true. And they want to eradicate bats. And that's one of the worst things you can do, because there are very few groups of mammals that have more ecological importance than bats.
David Schmidley is my guest. He's a mammalogist who has served as president of the University of New Mexico, of Texas Tech, and of Oklahoma State University. We're talking about his new book. It's an updated version of his original Bats of Texas. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment, and you can join us with your question at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is mammologist David Schmidley. He is author of the updated version of Bats of Texas. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org. So, Dave, are insectivorous bats, or fruit bats for that matter, adversely affected by pesticides that might be applied to the crops or to the insects that they want to eat?
Yes, they definitely are, and particularly bats were very susceptible to DDT, mm-hmm. which, of course, is no longer used in the U.S., but unfortunately it's still used in some places around the globe and continues to have an impact on bats. DDT is concentrated in high levels in the fat deposits that many bats build up that are important to their hibernation or their migration. And as they break down those deposits, those high levels of the chemicals that are part of DDT are lethal to bats. And so bats are very susceptible to pesticides, and in particular DDT.
You mentioned earlier, it's no surprise that some people are very freaked out by bats. They think they all have rabies. That, of course, is not the case. I was surprised to read that the rate of rabies infection in bats in Texas is higher than in the U.S. as a whole. What accounts for that?
Well, those statistics could be very misleading. Hmm. Texas has a larger bat population than other places, and it also has a growing, a very large population of people, and the number of bat people encounters could be likely would be higher. You would expect them to be higher than in many other places. Actually, the truth be known, I would be shocked that if it was precipitously any different in Texas than it is in most places that have significant bat populations.
So rule
and on average, it's less than 1% of bats are rabid. But the problem, Chris, is that that 1% often will end up in places where they encounter people. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know how to handle a bat or what to do, if you just find one lying in your yard, that bat is there because something's wrong with it.
Right.
Otherwise, it wouldn't be lying in someone's yard or in a place where people could touch it. And if you don't know how to handle bats, it's easy for one to bite you, and that, of course, is what causes the rabies concern.
How do you capture these little guys to study them in laboratory settings?
Well, there's a lot of ways. You can go into their roost. For example, you can go into caves, and you can collect them there. The most common way of collecting bats is to use a mist net. And a mist net is sort of like a woman's hairnet. You know what a hairnet is.
Mm-hmm.
And they're anywhere from 6 to 8 feet tall and anywhere from 15 to 40 feet long. And you can buy these mist nets, and you can string them in areas where bats fly, and that allows you to capture bats, and you capture them alive. And then, of course, you can identify them and release them, if that's depending upon what your study is trying to prove. And that's since the advent of mist nets in the 1950s, our understanding of bats has grown substantially. And that technology is still commonly used today. There are some traps, bat traps, that are used in front of caves that can be particularly effective, but those traps are hard to take out into wild, remote areas, and they're less effective there. So, for example, when I used to study bats in the Big Bend country of Texas, I've collected and captured thousands of bats there using mist nets strung over streams, because the bats will come over the water to feed on insects, number one, and number two, they come over the water to drink. And so if you put your net in an appropriate flyway, it's possible to capture dozens of bats in a mist net every night.
And did I read this correctly, that bats can swim if they have to?
Well, I have seen bats fall into the water, And I wouldn't call them adept swimmers like otters or anything like that, or beavers. But they can, if the water and the wave action is not too strong, they can maneuver themselves over to the edge of a body of water if the body of water is not too wide.
Any evidence of white nose syndrome yet in Texas?
You know, that's a very good question, Chris. I'm not aware of any at this point. I would be surprised if it doesn't appear in Texas, though, particularly in some of the large bat caves that occur in the northwestern part of the state, off of the edge of the Caprock, up in the northeastern quadrant there, or northwestern quadrant. There are a number of caves that that house large numbers of cave bats. The species is Myotis bellifer. And I think those caves, if there's not extreme care, are likely to end up with the white nose syndrome. Hmm. But to date, there have been no verified reports of it. There are verified reports from western Oklahoma, not too far from these Texas caves.
So the best thing we can do to prevent that is to change clothes, wash clothes if we cave a lot? Is that?
Yeah, or stay out of those caves. That's the best thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens is that fungus gets on the bats, and it disrupts their hibernation cycle. It causes them to awake and use up their fat reserves before they're out of hibernation, and that, of course, causes them to starve. And it's a very lethal process. Where it's been studied in detail in the northeastern United States, anywhere from 75, I think, to 95% of the bat populations have been wiped out.
So
it primarily occurs in bats that hibernate.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the most, the biggest challenge.
And we have some in Texas that hibernate and some that migrate.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
We have, in the northwestern part of the state, the primary hibernating species is Myotis bellifer. And the primary migrating species is the one that you saw when you were at Carlsbad National Park, and the one that occurs all over Texas in those large bat caves, and that is the free-tailed bat.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no indication so far that this fungus has made its way into free-tailed bat populations, at least that I'm aware of.
We know that bats hang out together in these colonies. What sort of social lives do they have?
Well, that's very interesting. They have actually a fairly elaborate social life. In these free-tailed bats that occur in these large colonies, the males and the females migrate to large caves in the Mexican plateau, and that's where they breed, and the females get pregnant. And then when they migrate back to Texas in the spring of the year, the females go into these large nursery colonies, and that's where they give birth to their young, and the males go into smaller colonies that are dispersed out around the females called bachelor colonies. And the bachelor colonies are typically much smaller than the nursery colonies. And so the female bats rear their young, both male and female young. They learn how to fly. They learn how to feed. And then they repeat that cycle all over again when they migrate south back to Mexico, and where they overwinter there, and the males and females overwinter together, and that's where copulation occurs each year. So you get that cycle repeating itself over and over and over again, and that's the social structure of that particular species. And other bats, depending on the species, have different kinds of, some of them are solitary, and males and females only come together during the breeding season. It just depends on the species. There's a wide variety of life history strategies.
Do they tend to partner up with the same individual multiple times, or do they play the field?
Well, they play the field, most people think. But, again, it's one of the mysteries of bats. Now there's some new technology, and it involves using DNA markers. And that technology is allowing people to study in much greater detail these mating structures of bats. And we're beginning to learn more about that, and they're a lot more complex than we thought. And I think it's very likely that some of these bats may mate with the same individuals more than 1 year.
Any insight into what makes a male bat attractive to a female bat?
Well, the females come into estrus, and like any other mammal, that's when the males tend to become attracted, and there are chemical odors and other aspects of biology, very detailed aspects of endocrine biology that impact all of that. And again, it's highly variable depending upon the bat you're talking about. But here's an interesting example. If you think about those 5 to 10 million bats that live in Bracken Cave, and the young are there, and the females leave the cave to fly and feed every night, and then they come back to nurse the bats, do they go back to their own specific young, or do they just nurse the first bat they come to? That was a question that was unresolved for a long period of time, but now using this DNA technology, we know that for the most part they're able to go back to their own young and nurse them, which is pretty remarkable when you consider how many millions of bats are located in that cave.
Yeah. By the way, we should say that it is a misnomer that bats cannot see very well. In fact, they see quite well at night.
That's correct. They do. Bats can see quite well. But, of course, when you're flying at various altitudes and you're chasing a prey like a small gnat or something of that sort, you've got to have more than just vision if you're going to be successful in capturing prey often enough to sustain yourself, and that's why they've evolved these echolocation systems.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Chris in Burleson. Hi, Chris.
Hi. How you doing, Chris?
Great.
How you doing, David?
Good. How are you, Chris?
I'm doing just fine. Very interesting topic. I have a two-part question. The first part is, would it be a good idea to attract bats to a residential area / neighborhood? And if so, how would one go about doing that? And I'll get off the line and listen to your response.
Thanks for your call.
All right. Well, that's a very good question. The answer is yes. Many people do attract bats into neighborhoods because they control the insect populations. And they like the novelty of having bats as part of their local environment. That's not hard to do because you can go to Bat Conservation International, which is located in Austin, Texas. It's the major organization for the protection and understanding of bats in the world. And at BCI, you can actually purchase a bat house. And the instructions come with how to put the house together and where to place it around your property if you have trees or other locations so that you can attract bats. And many, people have been successful in using bat houses to attract bats and make them part of their local environment. And, of course, you can watch them at night when they flitter and fly around outside lights while they feed on insects. The one thing I would caution you about, Chris, is don't try to handle the bats unless you know what you're doing. If you happen to find one in a place where you feel it could be handled, you should never touch it without gloves. And really the smartest thing to do would be for you to contact your local wildlife specialist and have them come over and look at any bat that you might see falling on the ground or anything of that sort. You just need to be cautious in how you handle bats unless you know how to do it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Danny in Dallas. Hey, Danny.
Hi, Chris. I was wondering what kind of bat species are found in North Texas, in particular in the Dallas residential neighborhoods.
What kind of bat species are in the Dallas residential area? There are a lot of tree bats up there. They belong to the genus, the scientific name of which is Lazyurus, and there are several species of them, and they're quite common in the trees around the Dallas-Fort Worth area and along the Trinity River bottom. There are many other species there as well, probably anywhere upwards to 12 or 15 species of bats that could occur in that area, the big brown bat, the eastern pipistrelle. There are free-tail bats up there in some of the buildings. And there are some other bats that are rare, but the most common ones would be the tree bats, the big brown bat, and probably the eastern pipistrelle in that region.
I was interested to read, Dave, that for red bats, which occur in North Texas, the terrible weather we have here is a big deal for them.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow that comment.
Red bats, which are found in North Texas, that some of them can really be adversely affected by the major storms we tend to get in this part of the country.
Well, that's true. I've known of situations, particularly where northers come through with sudden weather temperature drops and high winds at high altitudes can blow bats off course and result in bats occurring way out of their normal geographic range. Hmm. I had that happen when I was on the faculty at Texas A&M. We had a bat, actually, a big norther blew through College Station. A bat came down a chimney and got in bed with a person. And he woke up the next day, and there was this bat lying in bed with him. And it was a very rare bat, several hundred miles out of its typical range. And had obviously been blown over there as a result of that norther and the dramatic weather change.
I'm guessing neither the bat nor the homeowner ever forgot that experience.
No, I'm sure they didn't. the owner was pretty freaked out, I'll tell you that.
Are the wildfires, this is a question from Javier, are the wildfires in Arizona and New Mexico likely having an effect on bat populations?
Well, they could, because there are bats that roost in those trees in the forest, but I think for the most part, most of those bats would pick up and take off. The smoke would be very obnoxious to them, and of course, as mobile as they are, they would avoid, many of them would avoid the danger of fire. But in a very high wind situation where the fire is moving very dramatically and dramatically fast, it might be possible that some bats could, in fact, be killed as a result of a fire.
David Schmidley is my guest. He's a mammalogist who has served as president of the University of New Mexico, Texas Tech, and Oklahoma State University. His book is called Bats of Texas. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is mammalogist David Schmidley. We're talking about his newly updated book, Bats of Texas. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So I guess no other mammal has to give birth to something that has wings like a bat's wings. David, what do baby bats look like, and how long does it take until they're able to learn to fly and to fend for themselves?
Well, baby bats are born, you know, they have wings. They look very much like their mothers. They're just much smaller in size. And they
like jelly bean size?
And roost, and they're fed, they're nursed. The bats have mammary glands like other mammals, and within 2 to 3 weeks they're starting to fly, and it's a matter of 5 to 6 weeks. Most of them can engage in full flight, but they can't fly as powerfully or for the distances that the adults can.
Mm-hmm. And that first year is pretty dangerous for them.
Well,
for
it
reason.
Is. Mortality is highest in the first year or two of life. If they make that, then bats can be very long-lived. There are one of the ways of studying bats used to be to band them, like people used to band birds. And there are many records of bats in the wild living 8, 10 years or longer. And that's very long-lived for a small species of mammal. Most rodents, for example, wouldn't live more than a year or two in the wild. So it's a they are much longer lived.
We have an email here from a listener who says, I have an active owl house and have always wanted to put up a bat house too. It was a surprise to me when you said owls hunt bats. Should I forget about the bat house since I have roosting owls?
I would say no. I think you could do both. I wouldn't put them side by side. But if you've got a sufficiently sized piece of property, I think you could have both and attract both. Owls will feed on bats, but owls feed on a lot of things, too. They're more likely to take rodents and other things than they are bats because they're easier for them to capture. So I wouldn't be too totally freaked out about having a house for bats and one for owls. I just wouldn't have them side by side.
Any changes, Dave, in the Texas bat population attributed to climate change?
Yes, there are. That's in fact, Texas is one state where we know enough about bats and there's enough people studying bats that we've been able to document some major changes in the distribution of bats that appear to be associated with climate change, warming climates in particular. If you think about it, one of the first group of animals you would expect to be influenced by climate would be insects.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the bats feed on the insects. So as the insects change their distribution, it's not unlikely to think that the bats wouldn't change their distribution as well. So, for example, we have some bats that were not in Texas 50 years ago that occurred only south of Texas in Mexico that now are fairly common out in the Big Bend country. There's a species that 50 years ago in places where bat biologists collected bats regularly, that species was not there, and it's there today in very large numbers. And there are some eastern bats that have been expanding their range westward and southern bats that have been expanding their range northward. So bats appear to be, and you would predict this, fairly susceptible to climate change and are adjusting their distributions and their roosting sites to reflect that.
What do we know about why they choose this cave over that one, this abandoned barn over that one, this overpass over that one? How do they pick roosting sites?
Well, it depends, again, on the species. For example, these large populations of migrating bats need large caves with big cave surfaces. And so those species tend to occur there. But you can have multiple species within the same cave. For example, you might have three or four species of bats occupying a cave, and some of them could be very deep in the cave, some could be more toward the surface, some could be in narrow, confined systems in the cave, others could be more on an open roof. So it's not uncommon to find more than one species of bat in a cave. Bats also, when they fly at night, will rest, and they rest in places called night roosts. And so they may rest for a couple of hours before they fly and feed and drink again in their night roost. And the night roost could be outside of the cave. It might be in a building or something of that sort. And then there are bats that primarily seem to roost now in buildings. In old buildings, particularly old unoccupied buildings, or in buildings that have certain requirements and certain characteristics the bats favor. For example, when I was on the faculty at Texas A&M, in the old animal pavilion, we had a colony of free-tailed bats that lived there year-round. I used to take the mammalogy students over there, and we studied that colony. And I think even today, they still have bats that roost in Kyle Field, a football stadium where the Aggies play. And I know when I was on the faculty there, I used to get phone calls about coming and getting the bats out of the elevator systems in Kyle Field. These bats can be, if they occupy an attic or something of that sort, they can be a nuisance. You have to be you know, you have to know what you're doing to rid yourself of the nuisance, or it can be quite a problem.
If we're hanging around in one of these places in the daytime, do we have to worry about accidentally waking up a whole colony of bats?
No, I mean, if you were in a building that had a large attic system, you could have bats roosting in that attic system. I saw that happen at an apartment complex in College Station one time. There was a colony of evening bats that took up roost in an attic of a building, and there must have been 2,000 or 3,000 of them in there.
Wow.
And they would come through the air conditioning system and get into individual apartment units. It was not hard to solve the problem, though, because every night the bats would take to the wing to feed and drink, and we just waited until they were flew out of the building. We knew where they exited. There was a flaw in the building design, and we just plugged that flaw up with wire, and the bats were not able to get back in. And so it was not impossible to solve that situation.
Is there a particular bat or group of bats that every night decides, okay, it's time to get up and start flying around?
Oh, almost all bats will fly around every night. They take to the wing. They've got to feed. They have fairly high metabolic rates. And, of course, they also need to drink water. So most bats are going to take to the wing sometime at night.
But, I mean, does somebody wake everybody else up and they all get out and go?
No, I think their biological rhythms are set. So, you know, they're almost 99.9% are active at night.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they're active on nights when the moon's not out in particular, because they're less susceptible to prey, to predators on those kinds of nights. And on beautiful, clear, not windy evenings are the best time to observe bats. When there's sometimes, if the weather's very inclement, very bad, if there's thunderstorms, showers, high winds, the bats may not take to the wing, but most nights they do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with David in Louisville. Hi, David.
Hello, and thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I was wondering if he might be aware of a bat colony underneath a bridge in Round Rock, Texas, and if that possibly could be one of the male colonies that he was talking about, and I'll take the answer on the radio and I'll hang up. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Yes, I'm not aware of that particular one. The most famous bat colony at a bridge is at the Congress Avenue Bridge in Austin.
Sure.
There's about 2 million bats that occupy that roosting site, and of course, people come out at night and throw their blankets along the river and hang out and watch those bats fly and feed. It's a very popular thing to do in Austin. And it would not surprise me, with Round Rock being right up the road, that you wouldn't have a similar circumstance there. I have been on many occasions to the Austin Bat Roost. I have not been to Round Rock recently, and so I don't know specifically about that roost, but it would not surprise me at all if there were not a roost there. And it would almost certainly be primarily a bachelor colony.
Is there something special, Dave, about bats' circulatory systems that allows them to hang around all day, sleeping upside down?
Well, there are many unique adaptations for, how they hang that are part of their circulatory system. And, of course, with having wings, their circulatory system has to have special adaptations to get blood out into the extremities of those wings. And so, like all mammals, they have adaptations that fit their lifestyle and their life history. And, they're not like rodents or carnivores or things of that sort.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Mark in Arlington. Hey, Mark.
Hi, I was calling to find out if there's currently any hope of containing the spread of that white nose syndrome you alluded to earlier, and what, if any, might be the long-term consequences if it continues to kill bats at the seemingly alarming rate it's killing them.
That's a very good question. There are no known ways right now of curing the impact of that fungus on the bats other than keeping the fungus out of the roost, particularly the caves. And that's the best bet. And many places have, particularly in the Northeast, where this fungus has been very detrimental to bats, have just literally stopped people going into these caves. They're grading the caves and not allowing people in there. And that's probably the best way to solve this problem. You ask about the long-term implications of this. There's actually been one study that has said that it could be possible that the little brown bat might actually even go become extinct as a result of this fungus, because it's become so severely established in the cave systems in the Northeast where this bat roosts. Hmm. And some species appear to be more vulnerable to it than others. And the other possibility, of course, is that good old natural selection that Charles Darwin taught us about. It's going to take over, and there are going to be some adaptations that occur in these bats over time that will create some way for them to resist and be less susceptible to this fungus. And, of course, those bats will survive and produce more young and put them in the population. And over time, there could be some adaptations that prevent the mortalities.
But is there relatively long lifespan and low breeding rate? Is that a sort of a hindrance to quick evolution?
No, it's not. And that is part of the problem. The reason this fungus is so detrimental is because, you know, bats are long-lived. They have very few young, and they tend to concentrate in large numbers, which when the fungus gets established in their social animals, it gets the fungus moves from one bat to the next.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it causes the bats to start to wake up early, and there are no insects for them to feed on. A variety of things begin to happen, and the bats die. And, of course, if you have rapid mortality in a species that has a low birth rate, then you've got a real problem. That's a species. And local populations can be eliminated, and, of course, you get enough local populations being eliminated, then you begin to threaten an entire species.
Do you have a favorite bat species just for sentimental reasons, maybe?
Oh, I do. I like the spotted bat,
mm-hmm.
The one that's black with the big, huge pink ears and the three white spots on the back. I think it's one of the most beautiful creatures, and I've had the privilege of capturing one in Mexico. I've never captured one in Texas yet. I hope to do that one of these days. But it's a beautiful bat with an incredible set of adaptations for living as it does, and it's my favorite bat.
David Schmidley is a mammalogist who has served as president of the University of New Mexico, Texas Tech, and Oklahoma State University. His new book is an updated version of the original Bats of Texas. Dave, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Chris. I appreciate it, the opportunity. And I also, people that are interested in this book, I would point out that the illustrations and photographs are simply outstanding.
They are indeed. Thank you so much. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and Jeff Whittington is senior producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.